Today's episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dunn Street. Dunn Street is a campaign agency that specialises in community organising. We only work with people that want to build power to make the world a better place, including community-based organisations, trade unions, progressive businesses and social democratic parties across the globe. We develop community engagement strategies to win campaigns both big and small. We train engagement staff and volunteers in the Gantz framework of leadership, organising and action. And we help folks craft their story through the practice of public narrative that connects people through shared values and moves them to act together. And if you want to create change in your community, then hit us up at dunstreet.com.au. Today's episode is also brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. As Australia's number one plaintiff law firm, Maurice Blackburn believe the law should serve everyone, not just those who can afford it. Maurice Blackburn have helped influence some of Australia's most important legal decisions, including equal pay for women and Indigenous workers, and helped over 500,000 Australians get the compensation they deserve. Maurice Blackburn Lawyers, experience that you can count on. And finally, today's episode is brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community both online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, just visit their website, which is swiftfoxcrm.com, to win your next campaign. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left politics and organising podcast that drops every Friday, that dives into the progressive campaigns of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad. And on this week's episode, we are going to be talking to Brendan Donoghue. Brendan has been a journalist in the Victorian state rounds or Victorian state politics for over 43 years, working in both print and in TV. And after he'd finished up doing 30 years working for Channel 7, went and worked for the private office of then Premier Daniel Andrews. And Brendan is on the show today to talk about his time in the media and his adjacent view of politics, state politics here in Victoria over that period of time. Really looking forward to having a conversation with Brendan on today's show. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And if you like the show, please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Podchaser. And for all the updates, follow Dunn Street on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All right, let's get to today's episode. We are taping this one on a Friday afternoon on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. And joining me on the line is someone with arguably one of the most experienced journalists in Victorian political history, covering the careers of the last 11 premiers, working for, beginning with The Age, so the Australian newspaper, The Age, The Herald, may it rest in peace, the Sunday Age, before shifting to TV as the state political reporter for Seven News and doing that for 30 years. And then he saw the light and joined the good guys and started working for the Premier's private office, Daniel Andrews, as the Deputy Director for Media and then the Deputy Director for Communications after the stunning 2022 Labor victory. He's a winner of 6 quills. He has over 43 years of covering media, sorry, politics in the media. And is well placed to talk about what's happened over that same period. And he joins me now on Socially Democratic. Brendan Donoghue, welcome to Socially Democratic.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to talk to you for a while now, but obviously you've been busy, either one, being a journalist, or two, then working in the private office of the Premier. But now that you've got a little bit more time on your hands, I really am grateful for you to come on the show today. We've got a lot to cover off, but this is kind of like our St. Patrick's Day episode, given that the feast of St. Patrick is fast approaching. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get on at this time of the year. I know that you are a son of Erin's Isle. Where do your people come from?
Mum comes from Listowel in County Kerry, so on the southwest coast, and Dad's about 40 minutes out of Dublin, a place called Mullingar, County Westmeath. So they individually came out to Australia and met at the Moonee Ponds Town Hall, the Catholic dance, had a dance and held hands and four children, marriage. Fast forward later, they've now gone to God. They passed away a few years ago just before COVID at the age, both at 93. So they had a terrific life in Australia. And, they were terrific parents. And they instilled in us a lot of fun. And that, my dad would always say, there's only one answer and that's hard work. But we always had fun doing it. So I've always kept to that sort of ethos. And, we're very... very grateful that we had terrific Irish parents. In fact, I've got an Irish passport and my three children also have an Irish passport.
The golden ticket as well, because obviously that gives you access to the European Union as well.
Exactly. They're very happy with it. In fact, two of them are over there at the moment in Europe and one just came back to have another baby. So we had three over there at one point.
Fantastic. Have you managed to get back to Ireland yourself?
Yeah, I went in 86 when I was 26 and met the relatives, including my father's mother, Anne, who gave me £200. She was very excited. Now, £200 in those days was a lot of money. Then I went back in 96, bizarrely with Jeff Kennett when he was Premier. We went to Ireland and I saw my cousins or a few of them back then. Then I went back in 2006, so every 10 years, with Steve Brax. And since then I've been back personally. Well, I lived in Amsterdam for a few months with one of my daughters. So we did some trips to Dublin. And I'm going back again in July to take my youngest girl there who hasn't been to Ireland yet. She's living in London at the moment. So Fantastic. We're going to do the introduction.
What have you noticed about the country that has changed over that? I mean, you've obviously then got this sort of like a 7-Up experience here by going back every decade, the transition of the country to Ireland.
So when I went in 86, it was a pretty dark, bleak place. You could feel the bit of tension on the streets, particularly in Dublin. The economy wasn't going well. And then fast forward in the 90s, they called it the Celtic Tiger for a while, and they offered all these sort of tax incentives, and they got a lot of big American companies in there because of that. And it took off, although a lot of Irish young people leave, come to Australia or go to America or Canada or to Europe. But they started to retain people. The place took off. And then since then, they've had a bigger mix in terms of migration. And they've put it this way, there's a lot of Polish plasterers in Dublin. And they've had a boom, bust, and lots of debate. And they're having a big debate at the moment about migration as well.
It's funny, you know, I see a lot of similarities between the state of Victoria and Ireland, almost similar size population. But one thing I've always, that you talk about migration, and one thing's always struck me is that Ireland has always suffered from what I guess we call the flight of the earls, you know, the constant emigration away from the country. And something that I think we should be grateful of here in Australia is that our population has continued to grow, and from that comes economic growth and prosperity. And it's something that I think that Ireland could benefit from is trying to, one, retain its people, but also seek to bring others into their country to grow its population, and then with it, its economic prosperity. And it's something that I think they've grappled with significantly since they've become an independent state.
You only have to travel on the streets of Melbourne on the trams and trains, and you'll hear so many Irish accents, whether they're nurses or tradies. A lot of Irish come to Melbourne. St Kilda's the epicentre for them, staying at the all Airbnbs and cheap hotels and that sort of thing. But there's a lot of Irish voices around Melbourne. I imagine the same in Sydney, not too much Perth. That's more of where the Poms tend to go. But I think it's just in their nature. They're great travellers. Mm. And with the ease of travel now and cheaper flights and that sort of thing post-COVID, they do get out there and travel about.
Last question. Actually, no, I might actually towards the end of what your plans are for St. Paddy's Day. Let's get down to business. Let's talk about your time first of all, as a journalist. And as I said in the intro, you've covered 11 premiers. And I've got a series of questions that I want to ask you that will enable our audience to get a sense of how the relationship between government and the media has evolved over this time, in particular in this state. And it started with, obviously, the Hamer government. But before I ask you about that, I want to ask, where did the the motivation or inspiration come from for you to want to actually become a journalist?
When I was in my mid-teens, I was crazy on sport, whether it was athletics, basketball, football, swimming, you name it. And I loved reading the sports pages, particularly the Herald. And mum and dad would bring home either the Herald or the Age, not so much the Sun News Pictorial, as it's called back then. But I'd just devour all of the, particularly the sports pages, not so much the front pages. And I would read ETU News because Dad was a linesman. He used to get the ETU News. And but I was fascinated. I thought, what an amazing job to have the front seat of sporting history and being paid to write about it. Mm. And I looked at journalists who went to Olympic Games, and I just loved the Olympics since I was a little kid, collected all the cards you'd get and all that sort of thing. And I was lucky enough, I went through HSC, as called back then, the high school certificate, and I got into the RMIT journalism course. There was 45 places, 34 cadets who already had employment, and there was 15 non-cadet positions. And I must have interviewed well because I got one of the 15, and then I got employed the following year at the Truth newspaper as a copy boy. And quickly after that, someone left. Her name was Rohini Ratnakar, and she went to work for the Windsor Hotel because the Oberoi Group bought out the Windsor Hotel, which later on we may talk about how they connected with state politics. Anyway, I made a cadet on TV Week for about 18 months, and then I was moved to The Australian, where I was made the state political reporter at, I think, tender age of 20 and a half or 21. And I did about 5 years there, and then I became the national Labor correspondent as well for The Australian, which is basically the chief industrial reporter. So it was a bit of a baptism of fire. They were really incredible days. Trades Hall was jumping. The unions were really having a go. John Cain deregistered the BLF, the old Builders Labourers Federation. There used to be a right-wing carpenters union, the ASC&J, and there used to be the Building Workers Industrial Union, which was run by the Socialist Party of Australia officials. And, of course, you had Norm Gallagher, who was CPA-ML, running the BLF. And anyway, now it's all merged in the CFMEU and that sort of thing. So they were incredible days. Trades Hall was jumping, and it met every Thursday night. The pub was jumping, the John Curtin. Now it's all changed. I think Trades Hall might meet monthly. John Curtin Hotel's definitely changed over the years. Became more of a music pub, not so much a union or ALP-type pub. Although I did read recently that Trades Hall has saved the place and may even be one of the owners now. So, it was a terrific start. Lots of colour and movement in those days with unions. And then I went to the Age, 1985, worked up at Trades Hall, 3 years with them. And then in 1988, I was poached by the Herald to cover the state the state election that year. And that was when John Cain was going for his third. But the economy was starting to fall apart, and there were some great stories there.
We'll unpack some of those great stories as we progress through the show today. Let's go back to the Hamer government. Describe the day-to-day engagement between the press pack and the Hamer government. What was that like?
It was very gentlemanly. When I went up there, there was probably 4 or 5 radio stations like AK, UZ, DB, LO. And then, of course, there was the newspapers and the TV guys. And the first day I went up there, I was asked, do you play golf? We were playing in the annual golf day down at the Frankston course. And, of course, I went and played in that. And then every morning you'd be invited up to the Premier's office, which is still the Premier's office to this day, number one Treasury Place, and that concrete brutalism office that's been done up twice now, I think, over the years, once for asbestos and once because it needed doing up. You go into the Premier's actual office and you would sit around behind little desks and you would chat to Dick Hamer, and he would come out and stand and sit on his desk, at the front of his desk, chat. And at the end of the chat, if deemed necessary by the journalists, they would go and do audio for radio, interview him, and then the TV people would be asked, do you want to get some TV later on? Because they were on film in those days and it was a bit more to get a crew up there, and the editing process took a bit longer. And if that was deemed newsworthy, they would get a TV crew to come up later on. So it was all sort of by arrangement. And it was a daily chat. Of course, Dick Hamer had internal problems and he was moved out or resigned. His wife said that he'd been stabbed in his back. And another gentleman, Lindsay Thompson, took over. But, of course, it was not long before 82 came about and the 27-year reign of the Liberal Party finally fizzled out and John Cain won.
At that time when there's this sort of internal leadership challenge going on in the late 70s, early 80s, how much is that reported in the media or is it just straight reporting in those days?
Well, in those days, you really only found out about those if you literally had spoken to someone, unlike now where you can pick up stuff on Twitter. Someone can tweet something or put something on Instagram or Facebook or whatever. So back in those days, you were more reliant on personal relationships and ringing people on their hard phone. So either their hard phone at work, but the best way to get them was to ring their hard phone early in the morning at home because they couldn't say that they were out if you rang them at 6:30 unless they were keen joggers or swimmers. So particularly when I worked on the Melbourne Herald, I had great access to ministers and senior politicians purely by ringing them at home. And that was including, like I rang John Cain a number of times. He didn't like it, but we had his home number and I rang him at home a couple of times to check things, particularly important things. And another custom that John Cain had was his driver would drop him on the southeast corner of the Treasury Gardens, so down near the Hilton, and he would walk across the gardens for the last 400 or 500 metres, and I could go down there in the morning and wait and then walk along with him and he'd give me some quotes before he went in. Now, that just doesn't happen now.
That is just insane, isn't it?
There was no security at One Treasury Place. There was no security at Two Treasury Place where the press gallery was next door, which was the old education office that fell apart. The education moved down to Burke Street, I think, or Collins Street, into Collins Street. And now, of course, you can't get in anywhere near the joint without a swipe card and, you know, proper authorisation. And Jeff Kennett brought in the first security when he won in 92. Before then, you could literally walk up the first floor of number one Treasury Place and stand outside the cabinet room and wait for the ministers to come out and then interview them straight away, like put a microphone under their chin as they walked out of the cabinet room. Of course, that's all gone now. You can't do that.
The election you mentioned before, the election of the Cain Labor government in 1982, breaking this 27-year domination of the Liberals here in Victoria. Talk to us about the significance of that election in terms of the change in direction in this state, because obviously up until that point Victoria was regarded as, for the Liberal Party, it was the jewel in the crown, right?
And then correct. And Labor was considered the basket case. There'd obviously been the blue between the industrial groupers, the right wing Catholic based group, Bob Santa Maria's army, trying to take over and hold control of unions versus the left-controlled unions, and then unions caught in the centre. You had people like divisive characters like Bill Hartley up at the state headquarters of the Labor Party. You had federal intervention into the branch. You had a range of people trying to take over the branch on more interested in what was going on overseas in certain South American countries rather than what was going on in Victoria. And it took a long time, I think, study the history of the Labor Party. The independents were formed, John Button, those sorts, and John Cain was in the independents, and they had a focus on basically getting the party ship shape and trying to win government, because times had changed in that a lot more people were going to university, being educated. It wasn't just something that, you know, went to Blue Bloods to go to Melbourne Uni or Monash or whatever. There was a lot more young people voting, and eventually Labor had to win, but it had to present someone who inspired some confidence in middle Victoria, and John Cain did that in spades, whereas his predecessor, Frank Wilkes, didn't do that. He got very little traction and was more of a bland character. apologies to the Wilkes family, but that was the case. And John Cain presented, as we know, and he went on to win three elections as a middle-of-the-road reformer. He did incredible things, particularly in the areas of women's rights and gender balance. If you look at the VRC white line, women being banned from being members or not thought of being members at all at the MCC, which is just unheard of today, and what he did in other areas like FOI, and when he had momentary control of the upper house, getting through the work safe and workers' compensation legislation, then the Occ Health and Safety Bill.
You were working then for, or reporting for the Age, was it during that period, or up at Trades Hall?
In 82, I was at the Australian.
Yep. And yep, all through that sort of the peak of the apex of the Cain government's reporting on it from an industrial standpoint. Just talk to us a bit about the relationship between Trades Hall and a Labor government all through that period.
Well, a little bit like now, every state conference that was held, you know, either two or three a year, the unions were quite active in asking for things, and of course, they weren't always followed by the government. And the government, as time went on, started to had to borrow more. The economy was going bad. We had the state bank fail, the Tricontinental Bank disaster, the Victorian Economic Development Corporation collapsed. We had a lot of people leaving the state, and confidence was basically shot at the time eventually.
And you as a journalist, so you're trying to report on, you're reporting on this. I mean, how are you approaching this? Because obviously are you based in Trades Hall? Like, are you just trying to get the stories from the union movement?
When I was state political reporter, I was based at 2 Treasury. And then when I became the National Labor Correspondent for the Australian, I went up to Trades Hall. But you don't have to go there on the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always covered the Labor Party conferences. So I was basically always covering the Labor movement in a broader sense.
Yeah.
But when I was working with the Herald from 88 to the 88 election, I basically would start at 5:30 at number 2 Treasury Place, which is now the Education Office. That's where the press gallery was. You get in there early, you'd make your phone calls, get, the MPs or ministers or opposition leaders or whoever at home, get the story, phone file it straight away, and then it'd be on the streets at 11:30 or so in the first edition, and then there might be another edition about 1:30 or 2. And it would have a big impact on the day. The Daily Herald, it was referred to often in TV newsrooms as that night's rundown, because they used to take a lot of the breaking stories out of the Herald and run them up the top of the bulletin at 6 o'clock, because the stuff that was in the Age and the Sun News Pictorial was a bit stale by 6 p.m.
That sort of 88 to 92 period, which is sort of starting to see the downward trend of the then Labor government with Cain, and then obviously transitioning into Kerner. It just seemed, and I was sort of in, year 9, 10, 11, it just kind of seemed like bad news story after bad news story after bad news story. How much do you think the media played a role in the downfall of those Labor governments?
Fairly significant, and I was part of it. I was the one who I got a hold of, 3 years of VDC, the Victorian Economic Development Corporation's minutes, and I can't say where I got them from. But I can tell you it took a long time to read through them, and they were just a goldmine of stories about how the government was using, they had capital of 45 mil, which doesn't sound much now, but it was a lot back then. And they used the VEDC to prop up building companies who took on the BLF. They used the VEDC to try to bring in overseas banks. There was all these great sort of stories about the VEDC. So state bank collapsed. Everyone understood that. Tricontinental, a big corporate bank, also collapsed, and the VEDC collapsed. So there was just stories aplenty. And the stories were the king. They had to be reported on, and they were. But there's no doubt the rust bucket state sort of tag stuck. The budget was like a piece of Swiss cheese with so many holes in it. At one stage, I think there was 1 week under Joan Kerner, when she was Premier between 1990 and 92, where they were talking about borrowing to pay the education payroll. So things were pretty dire. And, of course, when your credit rating slips and money becomes more expensive, it gets harder to borrow that sort of money. It wasn't the only state in trouble, and it wasn't the only country suffering at the time, in the late 80s, early 90s, but it was pretty bad in Victoria. And I think the net debt went to about $33 billion.
I feel like the Kerner government, when Joan Kerner became Premier of the state, that I don't think she was ever given, and her government was given, any chance to succeed. I mean, from a media's perspective, you know, how did that look for you guys?
It
was a poison chalice, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, it was poison chalice is often the description. Of course, Carmen Lawrence had been made the Premier in Perth, so there's a bit of contrast there. But Joan Kerner was on a hiding to nothing. I mean, the cabinet was leaking. I remember it was a classic story on TV once, Tears of Fury, I think the headline was, where one of the right-wing ministers, I think I know who it was, he's dead now, had leaked to Channel 9 that Joan Kerner had broken down in cabinet and cried. So the headline that was tonight was Tears of Fury, because she'd asked them to all come back with certain budget cuts and that sort of thing, and they'd all told her, well, not all of them, but some of them had said to her, no, I'm not going to cut this and that. Mm-hmm. So the government was sort of falling apart internally. And just before the election, Steve Crabb, who was the Scottish transport minister, Wiley bloke who wanted to be leader, he held a press conference on the eve of the election basically saying Labor's internal polling is so bad, can you please vote Labor so that we have enough seats to have a basis or a skeleton of an opposition? It was looking so bad. They basically appealed to voters saying, look, we're going to get smashed. Can you just give us a couple of seats so that we can have, you know, in a democratic system, some form of an opposition? Because Jeff Kennett's just going to wipe the floor. And he did in 92.
Before we turn to Kennett, looking back on the coverage of the state's first woman premier, is there elements there of the reporting? I'm not talking about your own reporting, I'm just talking more broadly, like the polka dots and stuff. Is there, like today, that kind of reporting just would not fly?
There was too much emphasis on what she wore. There was obviously the polka dot story grew, and she said she never used to really wear polka dots, and I think she may have later on because of that. But the newspapers did sort of focus in on what she wore. There were some unfortunate clips of her in a swimming pool. She went to a factory and a forklift hit her in the head. When Lindsay Fox was there, there's all these sort of things happened, but she was a real trooper. She kept turning up. She kept fighting. But she was fairly there was too much emphasis on body shape, what she wore, what shoes, that sort of thing,
and not reporting on what's actually what the business of the government was each day. Let's talk about the Kennett government. So he gets elected in 92. How does the relationship between the government and media change or differ from the election of Kennett?
Well, Jeff's a very confident person, still is. You can say arrogant. He immediately banned the media from coming straight into One Treasury. So you couldn't literally go upstairs. There were security guards who put up there. There was security doors put in, that sort of thing. I wrote a letter. I think I might have been president of the press gallery at the time. I wrote a letter complaining. He wrote a letter back saying that Channel 7 wouldn't expect that he could walk into Channel 7, and I shouldn't expect that I could walk into his office. I did point out that one was public and one was privately owned, but that didn't fly. Look, the Kennett years were fairly incredible because they were fast and furious and colourful. The media loved Jeff Kennett because in today's parlance, he was clickbait. He sold a lot of newspapers. He did a lot of things. I mean, you know, he would go overseas and come back, well, every cab's going to be pink or yellow or whatever. He got rid of poor old Mr. Silvertop, had Silvertop taxis, they went. So all cabs suddenly became yellow because Jeff said, you know, we had 210 councils and something we had 71 or 72. A lot of people, there was compulsory of competitive tendering brought in. He got rid of public holidays, even though he said he wouldn't. He closed train lines. He closed dozens and dozens of schools. He sold them off, closed hospitals. So there was always something happening. And he thought he was invincible. He won 92, of course. He won 96. He brought the Grand Prix to Melbourne. He built CityLink quite cheap in hindsight when you look at it. Although the toll structure you could really question because it's now just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So there's no doubt he did a lot of things and revived confidence in Victoria. He sold off, obviously, the SEC gas and fuel, paid down the debt to zero. And if you're a fan of no debt, well, he did a good job in that sense. 96, I think he lost seats like he had Essendon, maybe Ivanhoe he lost. He lost a few in the north that he'd actually won. And then in 99, he thought he was invincible. But one by one, he'd attacked so many groups and categories of people, he didn't realise that a lot of people, he may publicly been the darling of the Herald Sun and other groups, media groups, but a lot of people in society were pissed off with him. And that's what happened in 99. He lost what an election he should have won.
We'll come back to 99 in a moment. I want to get a sense from you. I mean, to your point, he was good for business for journalists because it gave you guys good stuff to write about.
Yeah.
But in terms of the fabric of our democracy, was your job as a journalist in trying to cover the day-to-day business of the government, did that become more difficult under the Kennett government?
Yeah, well, there were things like you couldn't run audio in the upper – it's hard to believe now. You couldn't run audio from the upper house. And Darren Hinch stood up against that and just ran it. So there was all these standing orders that the media can only cover. John Cain brought it in first that you could film Question Time and rerun the vision and the audio. But in the upper house, you couldn't run particularly grievance debates and on adjournment where Labor MPs would get up and say da-da-da-da-da and so-and-so's done this, so-and-so's corrupt or whatever. Technically and legally, you couldn't run that sort of audio. So there were those sort of things that we had to fight with. He would also take you on wild goose chases. Like he'd say he was in Warragul that day. You'd get into Warragul, you'd turn up, then he'd say he was going to Ensay, and you go to Ensay. And then he was saying he's going back to Trafalgar. And, and you'd say, when are you going to talk to us? Mm. And then he'd just sometimes just drive off and not talk to us. And he'd just do his own thing. So he's very, very frustrating. But he was also very entertaining. Very entertaining for the media. He was great at grab. So the audio grabs were good. The visuals were normally pretty good and just unpredictable. You didn't know what he was going to do. And the same in Parliament too. And he would treat some of his MPs with disdain. I remember going to a dinner up Tobacco Country. I'm trying to think where Gary Ablett came from. I'll think of the town in a minute. Anyway, we're at the dinner and one of the local Liberal MPs, of course, came along and there was journos sitting at this big sort of round table and he yelled across the table to the Liberal MP, said, "Hey, vote, pass the salt and pepper or something." And we just stopped and he goes, "That's all you are, a vote."
Wow. "Hey, vote."
So he was open in disdain. If any journos were caught, I remember I went to school with Stephen Elder and Stephen once got caught talking to me in the garden of Parliament and he got threatened by Jeff Kennett in Jeff Kennett's office that he wasn't to talk to me. Now, of course, I could just ring him. But, you know, people, MPs were really pressured if they were caught talking to journos, particularly the younger, ambitious ones.
You're working now at Channel 7. How are you trying to make TV news interesting? Like, what kind of pitches are you looking for when you're out there on reporting?
Well, look, it's the old story that I would say to the cameraman, if it's a press conference, the most exciting thing that's going to happen, other than, you know, if someone intrudes and does something or blows up the room, most exciting shot is the person walking in the room. They may fall over. And the most exciting shot is when they walk out, they could trip over as well. And if you miss that shot, I don't ever want to see you again.
Yeah.
So I have 30 years, I think I said to the cameraman, can we please get the walk in? So a lot of TV stories are chronological. They start with the person walking in the room, making the announcement, they end with the person leaving the room. Of course, if you go out of the office, that's where it's the job of the media mind is to find a good backdrop, whether it's the Yarra River, whether it's Dwight Falls, whether it's the MCG, whether it's in a balloon, whether it's up a building, whether it's in a classroom with cute kids, balloons, a mud cake, birthday cake, you know, that's sort of a hospital, you know, people in the beds, that sort of thing. So there was all those sort of what sort of colourful background. And then, of course, bizarre things do happen, like backdrops fall on people's heads. They don't vet people and they turn out to be, you know, raving Labor supporters who bag the Liberal poly during the press conference. That sort of thing can happen. So, it depends on who the story, who's organised it, but a lot of political stuff is announced in Parliament or in a boring room.
When you're out on the road, are you looking for backdrops in which you can frame the shot in a certain way, or you're talking or working with a cameraman to say, you know, like maybe there's a politician who there's rumours that they are going to get knifed and they happen to be standing underneath an exit sign. Like, are you looking for that kind of thing?
Yeah, the exit sign is a good one. But often you go to events and the PR people have spent all day organising the backdrop. The cameraman will turn up and say, it's the wrong light, we're shooting that way. And they'll go, no, you've got to shoot this way. And they say, we can't match the light. Bad luck. If you want to be on TV tonight, we're shooting this way. So they'd have to quickly rearrange everything, particularly high building, shooting out over a bay. You really need to talk to someone who knows light, what time to do it, so they can match the light so you can see what's behind, or else it'll just be all blurred or burnt out, as they say. So a lot of that stuff happened. And a lot of the cameramen got to know people like Jeff Kennett and Joan Kerner, and you know, they had sort of favourites as well. They'd call them by name. There's one cameraman called Damien or Damo, and he's been around for so long that even the newsreader on the ABC series, they had the scene where the cameraman had their annual party and the first award went to Damo. Now, that's based on Damo, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So the cameramen are very important, actually, because they basically decide what gets shot, and you can only put to air what's been shot.
How important is the relationship between you and the cameraman in the work that you do?
Really important, because if you've got a grumpy cameraman, if you get into the worst thing is you get into a car with a cameraman, they're mostly all good guys, no women. There might be one female at the moment, but mostly guys, you get in the car. Now, if they're hungover, not interested in the job, it's a long day. But most of them are fairly good. They quite like the day trip, or particularly an overnighter. And occasionally we went overseas with the premiers, and they were really exciting times to travel and go to. Well, I went to probably 15 or 16 or 17 countries. Channel 7 paid, of course, not the taxpayer. But there were some cameramen who didn't like politics or didn't understand it, and some just go and turn on the camera and make sure it looks good and sounds good. Some really listen, and some know when something's about to happen, or they can literally see someone coming from behind, you know, waving a flag that's the opposite flag, you know what I mean, an intruder type alert. Working with a good cameraman is terrific, but sometimes they're not that great, but most of the time they're terrific.
Who out of the politicians that you've covered, leaders in particular, that you've found that have also have some appreciation, or maybe their office has some appreciation of the craft of TV journalism and communication?
Yeah, well, good question. I think because Jeff Kennett basically did what he wanted to do, like he could literally just say no or walk out of a press conference or not turn up or whatever. So his staff could do a lot of planning and he would just wipe it or whatever or just do it his own way. But I think Steve Brax had a pretty good understanding, and his staff did, about how just a little bit of work behind beforehand in terms of setting up the backdrop and that sort of thing means everything. The pictures dominate in TV. Like I would often say to people at work, there's a great story. The socialist left faction is bluing with Labor unity over this, and they'd go, "What are the pictures?" And I go, "Well, there's really not many. I could show them fewer people in Parliament." They go, "No, it's a boring story. Sorry, doesn't mean anything." So I do very few factional stories, unless it meant like a minister was being sacked or not pre-selected, that sort of thing. Yeah, so pictures are sort of the king or the queen. And if you don't have them, it has to be a really good story in itself to go to where, and then you go live and just do it live and just talk about it.
I've got more questions about the craft in a moment, but let's dive back into sort of moving through some of the history. So you talked before about the 1999 Victorian state election. Did you or did members of the media have a sense that there were cracks in this Liberal wall or foundation leading into that 99 poll? Because I remember it was all like when Steve Braxbeck took over from John Brumby as the leader of the opposition, it was like Steve who, and Kennett was obviously quite disdaining of Braxy. And this surprise election happened. I mean, looking back on it now, can you see where this potential upset was happening?
Well, I think anyone who says that they saw it coming are bullshit artists, basically. Mm. Because the Melbourne media saw Geoff Kennett through the lens of mostly the Herald Sun, and he was just so far in front of Steve Brax. But Steve Brax ran a decent campaign. What he promised wasn't huge anyway. He promised a cleaner government, more money for cleaning hospitals, a few other things. And I've got the pamphlet from back then. You'd look at it now and say, was he running for the local council? But John Brumby, he did a lot of work in the regions, and Geoff Kennett went to Ballarat once and referred to Melbourne as the beating heart of Victoria, and he said that the regions were like the toenails. So Labor got that ad and ran that all through the regions, time after time after time. And, of course, in the 99 election, there were three independents, one in Mildura, one down Wonthaggi Way, and one further down, Cabbage Patch Tree Guy. So there's three independents, and on the night of the election, the eve of the election, sorry, Peter McClellan from Frankston East died watching TV, died in a chair. So under the rules, you have to have a re-election because people were effectively voting for a dead person. So there was this excruciating period where they had to have the re-election, and Labor won. Matt Viney, I think, no longer with us.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Matt Viney won, and he did things like send out hundreds and hundreds of VHS ads, put them in letterboxes.
He did, actually. That's true.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure whether every household got one, but I was told they did. It would have cost a bit, but or maybe there was dozens or hundreds produced and they gave the media one. Anyway, Geoff, I think, once said to someone that he described Frankston as Broadmeadows by the sea. I've never heard him say that publicly, but he sort of had this sense of he knew that he was on a hiding to nothing in a way in that re-election. He went down there a number of times. He sort of didn't want to be there, you could tell. He didn't really get behind the Liberal candidate, a female whose name escapes me at the moment, Sherry, I think her name was. Anyway, they lost, and the three independents, Tim Pallas got in a light plane, flew around Victoria the day after of the re-election and got the signatures of the three independents, and Steve Brax became the premier in a minority government.
Remarkable.
And Geoff was shattered. His staff were shattered. They couldn't believe they'd lost so many seats, particularly in the regions, and that three independents had got up. Of course, Geoff had been very rude to the member for Mildura. He called him naughty words in Parliament. So he was always going to go with the Labor Party. And there was Susan Davies down Wonthaggi Way, who was more left-leaning.
Former member of the Labor Party, in fact.
Former member of the Labor Party. It was a fairly bizarre thing, but that was the end of Jeff Kennett in that sort of parliamentary sense. 99, and it was also the day that Essendon lost the unlosable prelim to Carlton. So I, being an Essendon supporter, I was in shock that night. David Johnson, who's an Essendon supporter, who co-hosted the election night coverage with me for about 6 hours, he was in shock. Not just about the Kennett result, but about Essendon losing as well because of bloody Fraser Brown tackling.
Let's take a quick break to talk about SwiftVox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust. Lists that are up to date, absolutely. Phone banks that can change minds. Emails that drive donations and events that will energize the community online and offline. And text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftVox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, go to SwiftVoxCRM.com to win your next campaign. Okay, let's get back to the show. Played a blinder. I handed out in, I think I handed out in Bentley that morning and then raced to the MCG to go to that game and then raced to the after party for Braxy down in Williamstown. And we were all crammed in. You would have obviously been there, I'm certain. And if you remember, it was not a, it was a lifesaving club, I think, and it wasn't a very big place and it was packed. Like it was like sort of felt like you're on a Japanese, like a Tokyo train at peak hour.
Yeah.
And watching you guys try, as Braxy tried to cut through the crowd to get to the stage with the media pack, it was tight.
Yeah. Well, the next morning, the Sunday morning, Jeff Kennett went to the tulip farm up in the Dandenongs, which was his tradition. And I'd been to, unrelated, this after the coverage, I went to a dinner party out in Blackburn, fairly senior journalist place, had a big night, and I walked in and they said, Kennett's won, hasn't he? I said, no. And they said, what? They stopped. They were all quite drunk at 11:30 or 12 when I walked in. And I said, no, it looks like he's lost. They said, bullshit. And I said, no. Anyway, the next morning I was a bit hungover, so I went to Williamstown to meet Steve Brax, and I was the only crew that went there. Everyone else went up to Dandenong, but I could only really face a smaller trip to Williamstown. It turned out to be the best thing I did anyway because I got great vision with Steve Brax down at Gem Pier at Willytown. People coming up and hugging him, that sort of vision. So that was terrific for Channel 7.
Talk about Brax as both a leader and his how he presented in the media, because I've had friends that were media advisors during the Brax era, and their take on him was that he was there was an authenticity to how he communicated in an interview, but sometimes so authentic that the media advisors had to go and try and clean up some of the stuff he had said. But in the end, it didn't matter because it was his positivity and enthusiasm that was so infectious. It was a part of this Braxy charm that people loved him. I want to get a sense of what was it like from the other end with the holding the microphone.
Well, there's no doubt he was actually quite nervous at the start. A couple of his advisors came to me and said, can we get some advice about Steve Brax in the press conference? And I said, what? They said, look, he sweats too much. And it was true, he was a bit of a sweater. And he's not the first premier who reacts to the bright lights and the tension and the anxiety and the pressure you're under. He would sweat, and quite profusely. So my advice was, you basically get a bit of pancake makeup, you whack it on, it blocks the pores for a number of, 15, 20 minutes, enough time to get through a press conference. And he actually did that, and he grew in the job. He was quite nervous at start, and often Steve would say the simple things that always got a run, like, this is a great announcement for Victoria, this is great for Victorians, this is great for Victorian schools, and then the media would fill in the rest. But he was, I think women loved him because he was a good-looking rooster and still is. There was a picture of him coming out of the beach down at maybe Altona or Williamstown with John Brumby, and there was a bit of a contrast. John has a skinnier body that's whiter, and John had on black daggy footy shorts. Steve, who's was fairly, still is, fairly ripped, darker, swarthy, and had the black speedos on, they both came out of the water, and it was a bit of a contrast. And I do remember a couple of female producers at Channel 7 saying, I think Steve Rex is going to win.
He got strong Lebanese genes, does Steve. So,
and also I think it was interesting. Some people try to portray him from the other side as being simple and not up to the task, but he proved not only did he win three elections, he got out when he wanted to get out, and then he went on to gather all of these other roles outside, whether some people struggled to get any commercial roles, whether he had people queuing up. Mm. And besides his pro bono work with East Timor, he had banks, developers, super funds, you name it, all lining up saying, can you go on our board or be advisor at NAB or whatever? And he had six or seven things straight away, whereas some other premiers have struggled in that area because companies don't want to touch him.
That's interesting. And just the way you sort of summarised the Braxy era, like won three elections, you know, 2006 being a historic landslide, goes out on his own. This is rare. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, you know, a bit of a unicorn when it comes to Victorian Labor premiers. We'll never see his likes again. We'll get to someone that we did see again into the future. But before we do that, we have this sort of Brumby into Bellew transition. I just want to get your reflections on the, you know, it's not easy in our Westminster system when you hand over to someone, like when Braxy says, oh, you know, I'm done, I've had enough and I want to go spend more time with the family, and you hand over to someone else. But the, you know, in the US political system, you sort of, you actually just don't, you know, got term limits, so you stop running and then someone else gets democratically elected by the people. But in our Westminster system, when you have this transition, you got someone in the job that actually hasn't been elected by the people in a general, right? I mean,
it's very hard to win. So Joan Kerner, of course, wasn't elected and she lost. John Brumby, who was a very good communicator, more forensic in his approach to things, a very smart guy, could speak across a number of topics. He had a lot of interest in medical issues and research into them and reform of them. He had, of course, the Labor machine behind him and people thought he would win. But Ted Bellew came across as a credible leader. He had a couple of policies, PSOs on stations, railway stations, in terms of more safety at night from 6 to last train, that sort of thing. And he got up by one seat. So I remember it was at the Broadmeadows Town Hall or the Hume Council Town Hall on the night where Rob Hulls had to come out as deputy and say, the results in the mail, code we've lost, and Brumby had to cop it on the chin. Very hard for an unelected leader. People don't like, I don't think, unelected leaders. They want to elect their own leader. And maybe they thought, well, it's time to give this tall, hulking former rugby player, Ted Bellew, famous sort of name in corporate Melbourne, a bit of a go. He seems like a bit of a centralist. He's not going to go around privatising everything. In fact, I think Ted sued the Labor Party and won over some of the ads they ran about Ted's company, links to companies about selling off private assets like schools. And he got up. And, of course, Ted got dragged down by from within. Because he only won by one vote. That's the worst result, is to win by one vote, because one person can drag you down, and he did, Jeff Shaw.
The covering of the Bellew/Napthine government, within 12 months of the election of the Bellew government, there was this narrative that they were a do-nothing government, that things hadn't got done. Is that something that you think came out of the media in terms of your own critical analysis of what they were doing, or is it, where did that, because that surprised me. I thought that was, I'm Labor, right, obviously, but I thought that was harsh. I was like, geez, they've only been in for 12 months. You got to give them time to settle in and get into the swing of things, right?
Yeah. So I ran the 2011 New York Marathon, and we trained a lot in that year because we could run in the morning, because the Bellew government often wouldn't do any in the morning. It would tell you at about 11:30 or 12 that it was going to do something at 1 or 2. So myself and the ABC guy and the Channel 10 guy, often we'd go for runs. We'd take our phones with us, but we'd turn up to work at 8 or 8:30 and 10 o'clock we'd say, well, there's nothing happening, let's go for a run. So we trained for a marathon and half marathons and that sort of thing. And there was a lot of talk about in the Bayou private office, Premier's private office, that on the desk there was a lot of files that weren't quickly ticked or crossed. They were sort of sitting there in limbo. Ted, well, I remember when he left, he didn't do a press conference. Well, he didn't take questions. He did a quick press conference at about 7:30 at night and then left. And I don't think he's really done a proper fair dinkum sit-down interview about the whole thing since. But he did speak in Parliament where he went through his list of achievements, and they sounded quite fine if you listen back to them. So that's all there on Hansard. But there was basically a belief and perception and a reality, I suppose, that it didn't do too much other than White Knight and PSOs on stations.
So it's now kind of heading into 2013, 2014, and we've got this bloke called Daniel Andrews, Dan Andrews, who's the opposition leader for the Labor Party. Your first impressions of Dan Andrews when he was first elevated to the job as opposition leader?
A big job in front of him. I remember his kids were very, very small. We did the standard, filming with his wife, Kath, and the three kids, who've all grown up now. I think most of them are through VCE. Big job in front of him. It's very hard to knock off a government or to make a government a one-term government. Of course, Ted, having gone through the turmoil of the Jeff Shaw years, the Frankston rebel who stood him up and basically brought him down, because Ted resigned on the day that Jeff Shaw resigned from the Liberal Party. So he basically lost the numbers on the floor because he only had a one-seat majority before then. Then you had the Dennis Napthine come in, and Dennis Napthine had never been popular, never really resonated with the wider community in most opinion polls. And he went gung-ho. He tried to do a lot, promised a lot, you know, whether it was the airport rail and trade with China and went to China and all sorts of things. And basically it didn't work. And the young Daniel Andrews and co. Had this policy of getting rid of level crossings, which a lot of people said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. How many are there? Oh, well, you know, get rid of 50 or whatever it was they started with. And, of course, if you get rid of a level crossing, you often get a new station as well. And as we know now, the opposition went against it, which is probably they regret now.
The government at the time.
Said all sorts of bad things would happen, about SkyRail and that sort of thing. And the Liberal Party lost after one term. But a lot of it is probably because of the turmoil that happened, as in it's very hard for an unelected premier to be re-elected, and Napthine wasn't elected, so he had Kerner, Brumby, Napthine. People said, no, I'm not going to vote for this guy who's just given the job and probably didn't like Dennis, or he didn't instill that much confidence with the majority of people as well. So all of those things came together, and it was a bit of a perfect storm that meant Daniel Andrews could claim victory on the night.
That 2014 to 2018 government coincides with a lot of change in the way that people broadly consume media. How did things, a similar question to ask you about sort of the transition from Hamer to Kane and then from Kane to Kennett once again, how did you see the way that the Andrews government worked with media to communicate their
their
narrative and their agenda?
So look, in the 90s it was 186 computers and then, you know, Microsoft, and they finally built up. But of course, social media exploded, you know, 15 years ago, and the start of Twitter and Instagram and Facebook taking off, and everyone becoming a journalist or a watcher or someone who could post, and the fact that eventually you could post vision from overseas. We used to take a bundle of American cash overseas so that we could rent a satellite to send back vision. Now you just send it out of your iPhone. So much cheaper for anyone to send stuff. The Andrews government had very good people internally who knew that you could go through social media, build this army of followers, and they might not all vote for you, but they're interested in you. He built up, I think at last count, it was about 1.1 million followers. How many people vote in Victoria? Is it three
four.
And a half?
Yeah, three four? And a half, four.
Yeah, so about 25% of voting age people following one person on Facebook and huge following on Instagram. And they did it in the way that it was quality, not quantity. I've heard Liberal Party strategists say you've got to just post stuff all the time no matter what. But if you do that, you just don't get the following. People don't like it. Young people turn off you. And I think the strategy more was real quality, interesting posts, and it built and it built and it built to the point where the media got really peed off. They thought that they were being gone around. And to the point where at one stage we thought, well, eventually they're just going to do press conferences and send out the vision, do a press conference with themselves, send out the vision. That was my fear, because with you, well, the other thing was YouTube. When YouTube came, you know, everyone can just post a whole press conference and then anyone else can pick it up. They used to send around discs and tapes, but now you can just obviously send it over the telephone system. So there was a bit of tension between the gallery and this just continual building of this sort of credible social media following, which the Liberals couldn't do and still can't do. If you look at John Pesciuto's or Liberal Party's Facebook page, John Pesciuto's Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, Matthew Guy's, who they twice trusted to lead the party into elections, they're just nowhere near. They had just nowhere near the cut through that the Labor ones do. So there was some pretty smart people in the Premier's private office who were behind that social media strategy, and you might know some of them.
I may do. The my recollections of the announcement that when they announced the Suburban Rail Loop plan, they did it straight to Facebook. You would have been still working at Seven then. How did that go down amongst your colleagues in the press gallery?
We don't, as a rule, you don't like, if you're the journalist who thinks that, look, we've invested in the round, why don't you come to us first? It's just expected you come to us first. And so that day we were told to come out to Box Hill. They did it in one of those new high rises up the top. And I remember chasing Mr. Hamer around, the Labor Party Hamer, who became the member for Box Hill. He wouldn't talk. And anyway, and the Premier stood up and they had a bit of a pamphlet and said, this is this credible policy to build this orbital link, because, of course, you know, 100 years ago we had an inner suburban rail loop and an outer one that went through, you know, Fitzroy and Brunswick and Carlton, and then the outer one went through sort of Blackburn, that sort of area, and just died off, and they were in the days of, like, little private railway companies. Anyway, it was just such a massive commitment, very little detail about the costs, because who could cost something that is to be built over 30 or 40 years? Anyway, it got a great white run. It resonated with the people out there, because if you look at the seats that Labor won at the next election, and then you look at the seats that Labor won at the 22 election, got even bigger, because, of course, the opposition at the last election said pause or cancel the SRL and use the money for health and other things. And that policy didn't work, obviously.
No. I want to ask you about the – actually, no, before I do that, there's a theory that the Andrews government – were a TV-first media strategy government, as in prioritising TV over radio or print. Is that your perception from the other side?
Well, if you look at the figures, it's roughly 1 million people watch TV a night, the five, six, and 7 o'clock news, and then of course you have the constant news on ABC and Sky and that sort of thing. And then you have to compare that to the Herald Sun's readership and how many people read political stories who read the Herald Sun, and the Age's readership. So there's no doubt that TV wins. And if so much effort goes into the backdrop of the announcement, that's for TV. A lot of the print journos don't turn up to the actual events. They just get the press release, make a few phone calls later. And in fact, a lot of senior, not all, but some senior journos work from home for certain reasons. They may have young children and don't come to too many events, even Parliament, when Parliament's sitting. So some people may have the this concept that all journalists go to Parliament, watch Parliament all day. A lot don't. A lot go for the door stops in the morning, question time, and then they leave, get out of there, and don't really cover debates and that sort of thing and all the other stuff that happens around Parliament. Whereas if you work in the Premier's office and the Parliament screens are on all the time, you hear it just nonstop about everything that's going on. So your brain is full of exactly every nuance from every backbencher, every crossbencher in the upper house, independent members, Greens, whatever, what they're thinking, what they're doing, that sort of thing. Journalists just don't have the time to do that, particularly with the advent of the 4 o'clock news, which is pretty recent, which goes for an hour. So they have to rush out, throw that together, do the 4 o'clock news, and then turn around and do the 6 o'clock package. So they're really quite busy in the afternoon. And that's why most media events are held at 10:30, 9:30 in the morning to give them time to get there, do it, go off, do question time, and then go back and do the 4 and 6 packages.
I'm going to ask some questions in a moment that questions the efficacy of journalists, but I'm going to ask a couple that might go lean more to some sympathy for the work of journalists, because obviously it appears to me that there is more news now than there ever has been, yet there are less journalists. And has that had an impact on the quality of journalism and the work that we're expecting them, or editors are expecting them to do and perform?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt there's fewer people around. I think there's 11 groups if you count the Guardian and Sky. I'm talking about the new entrants. So there's about 11 groups, and I reckon there would have been probably 16 or so, because most of the smaller radio stations have just dropped off. The only people who commercial radio rep at Parliament is 3AW, and then you have the ABC journalists who do both radio and TV. So no other radio station goes there. They take AAP copy, Australian Associated Press. So it's rip and read. That goes out to all newsrooms. So, and that, thankfully, is a very, very straight reporting, AAP. And then, of course, you have your majors in terms of your Herald Sun, the Age, and then the 4 TVs and, say, Sky and the Guardian, that sort of thing. Is there more content? Yes, there is. Is it of the greatest quality? No, probably not. But under the content rules of TV, it's very cheap for the TV owners to have morning news, mid-morning, afternoon news, 6 o'clock news, or 7 or 5. And then the late news, because it's all under Australian content, fills out all those content provisions. And it's cheap because once you've got the producers and the journos on payroll, you just basically make them file more packages. So there's very few journos who have the license to do what Nick McKenzie does, or Louise Milligan, who did the Four Corners thing the other night on Cranbrook up in Sydney, and I just heard the principal just resigned. So there's very little long-form work done, particularly in television, and little FOI. There is an FOI officer, worker employee at 7, but based in Sydney, who has to try to juggle all of the state's FOI requests. So, yeah, little capacity or want to do long form stuff that I just don't think it's worth it. A little bit's done with the Nick McKenzie types, who's, you know, pretty incredible journo. And a little bit's done by Four Corners, obviously, because the ABC does have the resources and the time to do that long form stuff.
Do you think that consumers don't I kind of think that folks are consumers of media are not I won't say craving, but I think there is a desire or an interest in longer form reporting. I mean, podcasts, for God's sake, like some of the most popular ones are the ones that are like these series that do a long form investigation into some kind of crime that happened in Minnesota in 1971, right? I mean, like, people clearly are craving narrative that is in a longer form. And I'm wondering why we're not seeing more resources invested into the types of things that, like, Four Corners does and Nick McKenzie and Louise Mulligan.
Well, it's funny with those sort of things. The podcasts of that they're done, particularly the crime ones, are done by the journos who are working flat out, but they decide to do a podcast on the side. Excuse me. And if you ask them about that, they may say, "Yeah, we did that. We do that early in the morning, or do that late at night, and I have to get together with my colleague to do it." And they're sort of side things they do. They like doing them, and it means they can talk a lot more. And because if you look at a general story on TV, is literally about 8 or 9 paragraphs. Like if you held it up once, I remember it was held up once in a court case and the judge said, that's the TV script. And it was like a bit of paper and about 6 paragraphs and a couple of grabs. So the average story might go, you know, 140, 145 seconds or something. It's seven or 8 paragraphs and a couple of grabs and a piece to camera. Whereas podcasts, you can talk for, you know, many thousands of words for an hour and a half. And because it's something that people only go to if they're interested in, well, they're going to be interested in it. And they don't mind listening for whether in the car or in the morning or going for a jog or a walk or whatever. They don't like they like that sort of curated stuff where you can go straight to. And a lot of stuff, people get their information not so much from the broad mass media anymore, but they just listen to the stuff they want, whether it's video on demand, audio on demand, podcast, whenever they want. Or they just, you know, look at their feed and whatever they're popping up on their phone.
I want to talk to you about the relationship between the press gallery and the and Daniel Andrews in particular in that sort of COVID, post-COVID era. My thesis is, and I want to get your reflections on this, is that Daniel's leadership continued to and his actions and his agenda and his strategy and the way he communicated continued to prove the assumptions of how politics works, and the assumptions by certain members of the press gallery prove them wrong. And every time they were proven wrong and they'd gone on the record about how they thought things would play out and they were wrong, that they were then right about justifying why they were wrong, thus then writing about themselves and appearing like they're up their own asses, and then getting backlash from their readers and then having to then justify the backlash against their readers, therefore getting further up their own asses, and then accusing, you know, voters of having Stockholm syndrome, which is the biggest mistake of all, I think, is telling your readers that you're wrong, and therefore losing their readership. Discuss. Yeah. What do you think about that as a thesis?
Well, of course, say the Premier may do 3 press conferences a week, and you can work out the days if you follow politics. I'm not going to tell you, but you can work them out. In this instance, we have an international crisis. We have press conference after press conference after press conference. We have people literally tuning in, you know, 1.5 million, 2 million people for the Daily Dan show at 10:30 in the State Theatre. And after a while, I think some journalists got so caught up in the fact that, you know, they had to work from home or, you know, they were inconvenienced. But it was such a big story, some journalists lost sight of the story and some journalists thought they would become part of the story. So I remember saying to one journalist, he rang me and he said, "I'm doing a story, you're restarting flights." And I said, "Well, that's news to me." And He said, no, it's happening. I said, well, this is a great story. What proof have you got? He said, I've got an email. I said, well, okay. I said, well, I look forward to seeing a tear out of the email. Of course, the story came out. No tear out of an email. Sources say. It was complete crap. Absolute crap. It hadn't been discussed. And I said to him, this is just wrong. I don't know why you're writing it. Oh, I've got this email. I said, but who wrote the email? Now, I'd like to know, if you've got an email, this is a great story, you know. We don't know about it. The government doesn't know about it, but we're planning to do something we don't even know about. So people started to get away with it. It didn't matter what the integrity of the story was. Sources say was enough. And I might add that there's a lot of sources in politics, particularly in election campaigns. A lot of journalists now rely on sources. I can't say who they are. I don't know who they are. But it's very rare, in fact, to get people to go on the record and be quoted in important stories. So if you go through the election campaign, sources say Daniel Andrews is toxic with women. An internal poll, the Labor Party's campaign headquarters is believed to be reeling. You know, sources say, I'm working at the campaign headquarters going,
Are we really?
The latest polling is 55.5. So who's reeling? What source are you quoting? And, of course, you can't do much about it because the journalists can never give up their source. And, of course, sources, I've often quoted sources. But I think there's a slight overuse in sources. Anyway, but back on the topic, during those Daily Dans, when they got over 100 in a row, because they were such a big theatrical event with a huge audience, some journalists thought that if they were to make a name, they would raise their voice. They'd repeat the question three times about restrictions in the meat industry and whether it would affect veal cutlets as much as lamb backstraps and whether it would force up the price, stuff like that. And then there was just the sheer, you know, you'd know when someone would come in, they'd have a camera on them, plus the normal camera on the Premier, you knew, well, this is just done for theatre. He got through that. I think most of the feedback we got that was like 60 to 65% of the public thought the settings were about right. They didn't like them, but they thought they were about right. And, you know, roughly 15% thought we didn't go far enough. Wanted us to go further, and then about 15% thought we'd gone too far, didn't want any restrictions, COVID didn't exist. And part of the media was they were just torn between COVID doesn't exist or it's very minimal, or you're not doing enough to stop that one truck driver coming across the border of New South Wales. You know, we're all going to die. So you've got to make up your mind. And of course, the truth was somewhere in the middle, and the Liberal Party actually reflected the media's sort of Arthur or Martha approach, because they couldn't work out whether they were pro-lockdown, supportive of the medical advice, or whether they were just trying to say that COVID didn't exist. So they ended up being all over the place and falling between two stools.
Your transition into working for the private office of the Premier, your expectations going in, were they? What did you think that the work of a staffer was as it related to how you knew how they worked from a journalist perspective, and then going in and actually doing the work yourself? What was like, okay, this makes sense, and what was like, oh, wow, I didn't realise that this is what this involved?
Well, I knew the results of what the office did because I saw the results from reported on all the time, but I didn't know the exact nuts and bolts. And I knew some of the people behind the results, but I didn't know exactly what they did and how they did it. But I soon realised that it was basically planning, and that everyone had their job to do. And whenever there were meetings held, you know, number of days out from the announcements, or parliament tactics and that sort of thing, everyone had their role to play and everyone played it. And I thought it was quite a really hard-working office. I was a little bit shocked by the hours, but they were pandemic hours for a lot of the time. I worked harder in the office than I did as a journalist in terms of pure hours, because at Channel 7, or, you know, you can stop at 6:15 and switch off, whereas working for the Premier's office, you're always working, and you'd often work till late at night, particularly during restriction changes. And then you'd start early because you had to know what was in the media and how to react to it and that sort of thing. So it was physically quite draining. I had to reverse my brain because my brain was geared to finding out stories and then telling people about them. And I had to reverse my brain to have all this information in my head and not talk about it when I was with my my friends and colleagues and family, and living with another journalist. I had to basically often come home from work and I'd be asked, how was your day? And I'd say, good. And I'd be asked, well, what did you do? And I'd say, yeah, fair bit. I really couldn't say that you were, something big is happening with, the Commonwealth Games or something, just the day before or so. So stuff like that. But you get sort of used to keeping things tight. And that was one of the strengths of the office, I think, that there was a lot of smart young people, particularly female, who were doing a lot of hard work, who would all come together in those planning meetings and they'd plan a good result or a good announcement. And whether it was liaison with Trades Hall, corporate stakeholders, parliamentary team, departments, media, digital communication, you name it, they all sort of work together. And there are proofs in the eating of the pudding when you look at the results, particularly the 22 election.
How much do you think the influence of the media on election outcomes has evolved in your time as a journalist, and as well as working in the Premier's office as well?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think when I first started in the 80s, a lot of papers were closer to papers of record, like the Sun News Pictorial. State political reporting was he said, he said, he said, quote, he said, he said. It was really quite very straight. Things became more politicised, obviously, when Rupert Murdoch took over the old Herald and Weekly Times. And as time has gone on, it's almost as though people have sort of pushed into taking sides. I don't think AAP does, by the way. I think, as I said before, they're very important sort of wire service that is very straight and very fair, which is terrific because it goes out to all newsrooms, country newspapers and radio stations. As for the effect on the voter, I think in the past, if The Age wrote a negative story about a minister in the early 80s, late 70s, they'd be gone the next day or be, you know, on really shaky ground. Now you can do pretty bad things and not get in trouble. It's sort of as like the public don't care, or it's expected. You can lose a lot of money, or projects can blow out to a certain extent, and the blowback is not that great. What effect does the media have on elections? Well, if you look at the last, say, the Napthine, when Napthine went against Daniel Andrews, I think there was about 40, 41 really negative front pages against Daniel Andrews saying, don't trust this man, basically saying vote for the Dennis. And it didn't work. And the same in 2022. Tin Review Australian and Herald Sun openly endorsed Liberal Party, which is their right. The Age endorsed Labor at the last election. How many votes they push around? I don't think too many. There might be a question that if there was a fairer coverage overall, would Labor have won more seats? I don't know. So the result was, 56 out of 88 went to Labor. Liberals won 19, less than 25%. So just purely on those stats, it doesn't endorse the concept that having the big media group behind you so blatantly actually wins you seats, because the Libs actually lost two seats at the last election. And Labor gained one, and that's what gained three, and the Greens gained one. So it's not borne out by the stats. Impossible to work out exactly, but I don't think those sort of that blatant boosterism works.
Why do you think they keep doing it though?
I think they thought any story to do with Dan Andrews sold papers. Like even when he, after he retired, you know, if he went to the local milk barn, someone took a photo, that was a big story.
Yeah, he came on this podcast and it got a front page run on their online pages of all the major papers and even the TVs ran it. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, well, he did a big sit-down interview, which he hadn't done with any of the papers or TVs. So it was important in that respect that you sort of went first in that area. I think there's a commercial imperative that, one, he sold papers and clicks online, that sort of thing. And, you know, John Pesciuto announces something, doesn't have the same ring. A lot of people don't know who John Pesciuto is. A lot of people couldn't name four ministers in the Andrews or Allen government. We overrate people's interest in politics, but they know if they've had a shitty experience with their hospital or if their local school's falling apart or if their train is constantly cancelled. So if you can get those three bigger things right in terms of health, education and transport, the sort of big grid issues that the Liberal Party sort of seems to not like those areas, well, you're well on your way to, you know, getting people's votes, particularly if you've got good policies in those areas and you're investing in them.
How did you get stories out of folks? What was your skill that you leaned into?
Well, I probably got a lot more through personal relationships, having come from the hard phone days, pre-social media, pre-internet. And I got to know virtually anyone who went through Parliament I've known over the last sort of 35 to 40 years because, you know, I'm I was reporting on the sons of them and working at the PPO with the sons of, like, Matt Viney, that sort of thing. So I feel a little bit old. I remember when Cinda Allen came into Parliament. She came in, she was 25 or 26, the youngest female. Fast forward now, she's Premier. She's, what, 50 or 51? So I've known a lot of people for a long time. I remember seeing Daniel Andrews as a young bloke smoking a cigarette outside the Mooney Ponds Town Hall where my parents met. And he was just an organiser at that stage for the Victorian Labor Party.
Yeah, head office.
Yeah, and that's where I sort of first met him and spoke to him about, you know, what's the vote here and what's the vote there and what's happening here. And he had a lot of success running by-elections and that sort of thing. So I've known a lot of them sort of coming through. So I've developed a lot of personal relationships with people, and I think it's important, whether the Labor, Liberal, National, whatever, that you treat them with respect. I always say, look, if they bend over and deserve a kick in the bum, they get it. Doesn't matter what party they're from. But I always respect the person. So when I call, normally they take my phone call, and normally a little bit of charm and questioning gets information out of people. But you have to have the spark first off, and often it's about keeping a really good diary and tracking stuff, and often it's just about talking to people about saying what's coming up, just asking the obvious question. What's news next week in Parliament? I broke the story about the government's dying with dignity legislation and upset a few people in the Premier's office at the time, but I knew it was coming up and I knew they had to decide it. So I remember one Monday afternoon I rang around a few people and it had been to Cabinet, and I got three people to confirm it, and I went live with it, and it stuffed up all the government's comms they'd had planned for the next day, and the Premier had filmed the whole YouTube, Facebook thing. It had all been done. Anyway, I found out about that when I went to work in the office, the effect it could have. So the bit of a yell went up in the office, bloody Brendan's got this. So it was basically by having senior people who would take my call, and the fact that I suppose I've been around a long time, I gradually became older than a lot of them. Mm. But, you know, you have people who often, when a big story is about to break, no one will answer your call, and that in itself says a lot. And vice versa, journos ring into the Premier's office when there's a big story about to happen. People say hold all calls. So that's a sign to the journo that something's about to happen as well. But I think charm always beats following Twitter, put it that way.
Second last question, and this is probably a big one, and I probably shouldn't have asked this at this point in time, but how does media need to adapt to survive, do you think? I know you probably could do a whole podcast on this, but...
Adapt to survive? Well, I think it's based on the content. It's a bit like no one's going to go to your pub and eat your food or drink your drink unless you're giving value for money. The printed media, of course, has a limited life. The printing presses won't be going in a number of years. Just not worthwhile cutting down a tree and making paper and doing it. Of course, most things are online now. No one reads newspapers. You go on a train or a tram, no one's reading a newspaper unless it's some old duffer going in to check on his shares in town. They have to curate their content so that it's interesting to young people. I've got three kids in their 20s and early 30s, and they're not interested in mainstream media. They listen to podcasts or whatever they want on YouTube or whatever sort of streaming medium, but they're not really interested in mainstream TV news. So you have to, whether you use minor channels or all those secondary channels that TV stations now can have to appeal to young people, try to get a generation to hook onto you. Because if not, they'll sort of be lost. Majority of people who listen to, say, 3RW or watch the 6 o'clock news are fairly old. There's not a massive audience under 35 or so. There's a lot of adapting needs to be done. We are in an era, though, that, Taylor Swift, breaks her ankle would be the biggest story. Would probably be bigger than, Joe Biden's taken to hospital after he breaks his hip. So, and the Taylor Swift thing would last, go longer and sell more papers and whatever, be more clicks. So celebrity journalism is always going to be quite big. Where to get the best Palmer, the best coffee, stuff like that. So maybe they have to go more into that sort of information. But it's hard to see investigative journalists getting a massive run in future because there's not that appetite to put the money and resources behind them. A lot of the papers do podcasts now, of course, but they're fairly, focused on, the crime area or an historical wrong, that sort of thing. So they go back over the years and find out who really did what to who and that sort of thing, and they're interesting to people. It's a pretty vexed issue about how do you get people to listen or watch or read when I think in some ways a lot of former viewers and readers have lost faith in some of the content and particularly in the political area. But they're more interested in reading about sport, but the sport's often live, so you've got it on TV or radio anyway.
I mean, that's a whole other area I could talk about, sports journalism, but maybe we'll have to get you back on the show for another chat, Brendan. Thank you so much for your time today. Really found it incredibly fascinating and I appreciate you going back and sharing your experiences as a journalist in this state. Last question, which is an easy one. What's the plans for the 17th of March for Brendan Donohue?
Well, my nephew's getting married up in Sydney. So
on St. Patrick's Day.
On the Saturday, so I'll be at a recovery.
Oh, right, of course.
Yeah, and then flying back in the afternoon. So normally I do have a golf day. That's been put off to the 24th. So I think it might St. Patrick's Day might go a week. But no, we normally have a couple of Guinness and get a cab home. We used to have really rollicking Irish affairs up at State Parliament, back of the Celtic Club. It's got a checkered history, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we don't go as hard as we used to. I remember once Pat McNamara, when he was deputy premier, he loaded up his government car. There was people in the boot as we drove down to the Celtic Club after having the Irish night at Parliament. But that's the way things happened back then.
Yeah, so not pulling that stunt off, I don't think, these days.
No.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your future endeavours and I hope you have a happy St. Patrick's Day. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Cheers. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks for listening to Socially Democratic. Did you like the podcast? Hit the follow or subscribe button and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcast or Podchaser. And to get all the latest on Socially Democratic, follow Dunn Street on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we'll see you next Friday. Socially Democratic was brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. Maurice Blackburn Lawyers have spent more than a century paving the hard path to justice for everyday Australians. They've helped over 500,000 Australians turn their situation around, and they know how the system works. Their experience and skills means you'll get the best results possible. Find out more on their website, mauriceblackburn.com.au. Maurice Blackburn, experience you can count on. Socially Democratic was brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. To find out more, go to swiftfoxcrm.com to win your next campaign.